Welcome to Don't Miss a Beat, live from ACC 2024 Congress in Atlanta, Georgia. We are so excited and privileged to be joined by Dr. Javed Butler. He is a dear friend, close colleague, and really an important mentor throughout both our careers. Dr. Butler is a professor of medicine and clinical trialist at Baylor Scott & White in Dallas. And is the most popular person at ACC 2024, is leading many of the important investigations, clinical trials. And we'd like to spend this session on MPACT-MI. MPACT-MI has been voted by many as being one of the most highly anticipated clinical trials coming out of ACC 2024. And tackles an important issue, tackles perhaps one of the final pillars of SGLT2 inhibition across cardio-kidney metabolism, and also has many unique aspects. And so we're going to push you, we're going to test you here. And I'd like to begin just broadly, before we dive into some of the details of MPACT, in this whole construct of clinical trials in which we've traditionally approached trials of heart failure with reduced ejection fraction in parallel with trials of post-MI-LV dysfunction. And in general, we've seen some concordance. But more recently, perhaps with ARNI, perhaps with DAPA-MI, we've seen perhaps some discordance in results. And so do you think that this is still a viable approach to how we are actually conducting clinical trials? Are these similar disease models that we should be expecting concordant findings are in terms of preventing important clinical events?
Yeah, I mean, so first let me say how excited I am to be here as well, you know, so presenting the clinical trial results. This is hometown, but especially talking to the two of you because of the long-term working relationship that we have had. Although that whole comment about being most popular, I'm not sure about that, but the rest was pretty objective. So look, I mean, we have done these trials and, you know, actually at three stages, right? So some trials go with really sick patients first, like Rawls and consensus. Some trials go with, you know, less sick patients that we did with beta blocker. So it's less sick patient, more sick patient, and post-MI patient. And we have sort of looked at in all of these three patient populations, and that model works. Now, the question here is that going forward, do we need to continue these models because of several things? One is that this is thousands and thousands of patients incurring up a lot of cost. But also we tend to do these trials in a serial manner. So it's like, you know, it's a 10-year development program as well. And the question is, can we live in a different world where we have much broader inclusion criteria and try to sort these things out with some sort of consistency of finding some interaction analysis, some Bayesian borrowing from some other studies and whatnot? I think that's a pretty viable model. I think that the trialist will get there faster. But the regulatory and the guidelines, I think we will need to think that through a little bit. But I think that for the time being, this is the standard and that's what we do.
So with that background, let's get into the details of MPACT. And, you know, one of the things we know about this study design was that it had some streamlined and pragmatic features of it. And also that the sample size also changed a little bit as with the design as things went forward with the trial. So walk us through, like, you know, the basic eligibility, operations, and how the trial was executed.
Yeah, so there's a lot sort of hidden there. So, you know, the part of the pragmatic or the streamlined trial was that we really wanted to do a trial which was applicable to most patients. So that's one thing, broad eligibility criteria, which in turn then translates into broader generalizability criteria as well. So that was one thing. The second thing is that we really want to lower the burden on the clinical site investigators as well as the patients as well, because the clinical trial sometimes can be very, very cumbersome. So the pragmatic features were, or the streamlined features were, one is that the inclusion exclusion criteria, you could literally just get all of them in your routine clinical practice and you didn't have to do any additional tests. The data that we collected, relatively thin CRFs, you know, not lots and lots of data collection that when we, you know, at the end of the trial say, well, why did we collect this data? We'll never look at it. So relatively limited data collection. I'll give you one example, for instance, that we only collected medication changes up till the first 6 months post-discharge, not throughout the trial, except for open label SGLT2 inhibitor use. But otherwise, first 6 months, we didn't collect data on medication after the 6 months. So that was the second thing. Third is that the safety, gosh, like we know so much about SGLT2 inhibitor safety that there was very focused safety data collection. But the final and the biggest one was that there was no central adjudication of the cases. So that led to two things. One, is that our primary endpoint was all-cause mortality or first heart failure hospitalization. And the not doing adjudication brings a lot of pragmatic ease to the trial, but it comes at a little bit of a cost. And the cost here is that all cardiovascular trials have cardiovascular mortality as a primary endpoint, whereas we had all-cause mortality. So maybe some built-in noise there. So that's one. And then the second is that we did not have any outpatient heart failure events, which again, you know, you sort of have to make the trade-off. But we started the trial in 2020. So COVID was going on. That affected hospitalization. Two regions that the trial was active was involved in a war. That may affect. And in general, sort of more outpatient. So those are sort of the trade-off that was made. So with that said, the inclusion criteria was STEMI, non-STEMI, diabetes, no diabetes, type 1 diabetes was excluded. The bottom line is within the first 14 days. So again, try to get as soon as possible, but definitely within the first 14 days, enrolled empagliflozin in 10 milligram or placebo, and then long-term follow-up on top of standard of care as you wish. So like for instance, 90% of our patients got reperfusion, revascularization therapy, for instance. We required the patients to be at high risk for heart failure. So if you already had history of heart failure at the time of MI, you were excluded. But if you did have history of heart failure, you came in and you either had signs, symptoms of congestion requiring treatment, then your EF could be anything, 60%, doesn't matter. Or you had a new drop in EF to less than 45%. So that was built into the trial. And then we had a sort of a series of 8, 9, 10 criteria, which were the enrichment criteria, and you had to just meet one of those criteria in addition.
So, and then beyond that seemed like a simple randomization of the SGLT2 inhibitor compared to placebo. And before we get into the results, this is just following the results of DAPA-MI. And so in terms of that inclusion, in terms of that design, were there any important differences?
So three things come to mind. So DAPA-MI excluded patients with diabetes, type 2 diabetes, we included that. So that was a big difference. Two, obviously, for logistics and other things, DAPA-MI changed their primary endpoint from clinical to a 7-point win ratio. A lot of that was targeted towards the comprehensive cardiometabolic picture rather than heart failure mortality picture. So we had sort of, we waited for the full number of events. So looking at the traditional cardiovascular, that was the second difference. The third thing, which was actually not different between the two, is that the event rate was lower. So I did answer your question about increasing the sample size during the trial. And that was that our event rate was much lower than what we were anticipating at the time of starting the trial. And I think the fundamental reason for that is that there is a complete flip of the ratio of STEMI to non-STEMI in real world versus clinical trials. If you look at the large registries, MI data in the real world, almost 3/4 of the patients have STEMI, have non-STEMI. And again, when I used to be young, like you guys, STEMI actually had worse prognosis. Now, STEMI with door to balloon time, angioplasty, boom, you know, so, you know, our common friend Scott Solomon has said this on multiple times, you cannot make better. So if you come in, your only problem is a STEMI, 30 minutes, you get revascularized, you're done. I mean, you're at a really low risk. So, but the non-STEMIs in this day and age are actually at a higher risk than STEMI. In registries, 3/4 are non-STEMIs, 1/4 are STEMIs. Both Paradise MI and Impact MI, 3/4 are STEMI, 1/4 is non-STEMI. So that flip enriches you for a lower risk population and the event rates are lower, so we have to increase the sample.
What about the other baseline characteristics? You know, you talk about how it was a lot of STEMI, 3/4 STEMI or so, but were the other patient characteristics kind of what you expected in this kind of patient population?
So we had, you know, as I said, about, you know, 90% of the patients got revascularization therapy, 3/4 for men, 25% for women. So it wasn't as low, but clearly not equal to what the epidemiology is. So getting some, you know, more enrollment of women and minority, we also struggle with. About a third of the patients or so had diabetes, 17% or so has history of hypertension, about 15% or so had prior history of myocardial infarction, GFR less than 60 was, I think, about 25% of the patients. So pretty mixed usual population. I
guess the background therapy was also really well treated. And
so that's sort of interesting, right? So what do you call background therapy? So I would, although it's not background therapy, I would call background therapy what was the therapy patients were getting at the time of discharge. Because now MI has occurred.
Sure.
So people who come in, their backgrounds are very different. But at the time of discharge, we had 80%+ RAS inhibitor use, 80%+ beta blocker use, 95%+ antiplatelet use, 90%+ statin use. And the glass half full is that MRA use was about 48%, getting close to 50%, so better than what we have seen traditionally. But obviously, glass half empty is that 50%.
Perfect. So you've set the bar very high for yourself. You've designed a pragmatic trial. You have enrolled patients that have had excellent standard of care, it seems, have undergone prompt revascularization, are on excellent background medical therapies that have been shown to reduce these target events. What were the primary results of MPACT-MI?
Yeah. So the primary endpoint, just to remind you, was time to first heart failure hospitalization or all-cause mortality. We did not reach our primary endpoint. There was a 10% relative risk reduction in the primary endpoint that was not statistically significant. P-value was 0.21. Now, when we dissect the primary endpoint into its components, there was no signal of mortality benefit, but there was a 23% relative risk reduction, statistically significant, and heart failure hospitalization. And then we had also pre-specified total heart failure hospitalization, first and recurrent combined. And that was 33% relative risk reduction, also highly statistically significant. So not only directionally, but even the magnitude of benefit in the 25 to 30% range is very consistent with what we have seen in patients with diabetes, in patients with CKD, and in patients with heart failure, regardless of diabetes and regardless of EF. So in that sense, the story is pretty consistent. But the discomfort you have here now is that the primary endpoint is negative and there's a component positive, but it's not sort of you just squeak by. It's pretty positive, 25 to 30% relative risk reduction. So how do you sort of interpret it, or what sort of sensitivity analyses that were done? So I'll mention just a couple. We did, as you might imagine, we have done a ton of analysis with all sorts of definition, and the data were consistent. But the two that I would mention to you is that outpatient heart failure was not collected as part of the primary endpoint because you were trying to do a pragmatic trial. But what's interesting is that a serious SAE of heart failure was collected that had three components: heart failure hospitalization, death due to heart failure, or outpatient heart failure event. So the site could notify heart failure event as an AE. So that was collected. If we now include that in the endpoint, so 23% time to first, 33% total. If you include outpatient heart failure event, there was a 37% relative risk reduction. We're also in our primary endpoint, more than 50% of the event were mortality events. If you include the outpatient event, our sort of exploratory made-up primary endpoint of all-cause mortality and total heart failure event was statistically significantly positive. So I think there are some sort of these issues. So then we said, well, what else can we do to pressure test our results? So remember I said in the beginning that we collected data on medications for the first 6 months. So we said, well, you know, one surrogate could be that you have been started. So, you know, we have a discomfort that this outpatient heart failure is a SAE. So what exactly does that mean? Well, why don't we correlate that with initiation of heart failure medications in the outpatient setting? All four analyses we did, new ARNI use, new RAS inhibitor use, new MRA use, new diuretic use post-discharge, 25 to 30% higher in the placebo versus SGLT2 inhibitor empagliflozin arm. So we are sort of getting all of these signals, data come together. Now, again, I mean, we can argue heart failure is the biggest cause for mortality. Like, why isn't mortality signals? Maybe we can get into that. But these are sort of the overall results.
Gotcha. So yeah, I mean, taking that in, I mean, it does seem very consistent with the heart failure prevention properties that we've seen in the type 2 diabetes space, the chronic kidney disease space, and now post-MI space. Subgroup analyses or anything, any sensitivity analyses, but what about the subgroup analyses?
Very consistent. So the lack of mortality signal remained lack of mortality signal, and the beneficial heart failure signal remained beneficial heart failure signal across many, many, many subgroups we did. We will need to dig into a little bit more data on the sex specific, because we did see some interaction between male men and women. But unlike some of the other therapies where one is benefiting and one is harming, that's not what we saw. Benefit was seen in the overall group, but one group benefited more than the other. So we need to understand that a little bit more, but by and large, really nothing in the system.
And Javed, some may wonder, well, SGLT2 inhibitors have been shown to be beneficial in many populations, some that overlap with MPACT MI. For instance, patients with chronic kidney disease or patients with diabetes at high cardiovascular risk. And so in the population sort of previously unstudied or understudied that don't have indications or labels globally, does MPACT MI actually show that you can prevent heart failure in that group of people?
Yeah, so I don't want to give you a precise answer because that precise sub-study is on the docket to be done. So I don't have the numbers per se. But in a way, I can answer sort of indirectly. So first of all, this is the population that we studied. Maybe we can get into the discussion, you know, how do you interpret a secondary endpoint if the primary is negative? That's a genuine discussion to be had. But this is the population we studied, and that the signal is such that I probably would not necessarily try to dissect too many populations. One, we looked at 8-10 subgroups, no differences. Then we looked at the inclusion criteria of congestion, LVEF, or the combination thereof. Everybody was seemed to be benefited. And remember, for instance, the EMPEROR outcomes trial, all patients had atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease. It's just that it was a remote history and not an acute history. So if you sort of take an overall bigger picture, that's what it looks like. So we ended up actually doing a meta-analysis of all SGLT2 inhibitor large trials across all disease states, including DAPA-MI and MPACT-MI as well. That paper will be coming out soon as well. And what's interesting is that there was a 29% relative risk reduction for heart failure hospitalization and 30% heart failure hospitalization, and we fit right in the middle there with MPACT-MI.
So it raises the intriguing message, at least for this drug class, that it seems to reduce a target of, that is, heart failure prevention, very consistently across populations. And while traditionally we've had labels that are indication-specific for specific disease populations, perhaps we need to take a step back and say this drug class prevents heart failure in these populations. And similar to a label, for instance, like sotagliflozin, which is prevention of heart failure events in these studied populations. And so really, really intriguing results and data. I'm wondering about an issue around competing risks. And so, you know, the nice thing of a composite with mortality is that you account for patients who are very high risk, who die of other reasons, as MPACT really was enriched for comorbidities. And so how do you, if you do account for competing risks, do you still see a heart failure beneficial signal in terms of prevention?
So remember that the primary endpoint obviously was a composite of mortality hospitalization, but then was also controlled for a whole bunch of characteristics as well. So this is sort of very well-controlled, multivariable, adjusted model that we use. I think my sort of interpretation is, and I'm going to wear a little bit of a Bayesian hat and take off my frequentist hat to sort of answer this question. I mean, the question is not effectiveness in my mind. The question is sort of cost-effectiveness, right? So as you accumulate these comorbidities, your absolute risk goes up. So for the same relative risk reduction, you get much more absolute risk reduction and therapies get more cost-effective. On the other hand, cost-effectiveness is also a little bit of a tricky thing because drugs go generic, right? So that the cost-effectiveness value changes as well. So at least in my mind, patients who meet the entry criteria, remember, we did not include all MI patients. It's all MI patients with a new drop in EF or congestion, right? So in that patient population, after risk adjustment, we are seeing such consistent signal that I'm not at all concerned about the competing risk. Now, if somebody asks me, well, should we just give it to all heart failure patients? I can subjectively say, you know, that kind of makes sense because these patients are enriched for cardiometabolic conditions. But that's where the absolute risk may be lower. So the absolute risk reduction may be lower. And then the cost effectiveness becomes an issue overall. So I think we will sort of struggle with that a little bit. But if you meet the criteria of MPACT, I am pretty.
So kind of take your take-home message from this trial, integrating what we also know from DAPMI. You know, if you were writing guidelines or a take-home point for our audience, you know, how are you going to integrate these data and what we should be doing in our own practice today?
Look, we are all three clinical trialists, so we get pretty excited about these things. Remember that the alpha in a trial is targeted and protected for that trial. The alpha for any outcome, if you are Bayesian inclined, is borrowed across multiple trials. So the alpha is very different for an outcome as opposed to the clinical trial. So yes, our p-value did not hit the primary endpoint, but the consistency of heart failure signal across 7, 8, 9 trials and the p-value being significant here and the 30% relative risk reduction, I am Bayesian by sort of my orientation. So I don't think the matter is right or wrong. The matter is that the next guidelines committee, the composition, will it be more frequentist oriented guidelines writer or Bayesian writers? If it's frequentist, I think they will be concerned about the primary endpoint, and it may be either a mention or maybe, you know, 2B or something like that. And if it's a Bayesian, then I think they'll do the right thing. And then they will say, well, post-MI patients who are have these characteristics, people have a substantial reduction. I mean, the rub here is that if we all say that heart failure is one of the worst prognostic signs post-MI, and what is it worst prognostic sign of? Well, mortality. So if you have a 30% reduction in mortality, why? I mean, 30% reduction in hospitalization or new onset heart failure, why is there no mortality signal? That's the elephant in the room. And at least sort of my interpretation is that, but remember, I've been looking at these data for 3 weeks in and out now. So I may be biased. You guys will be the judge. Neutrals are listening to my interpretation. So one, more than 50% of the primary endpoint events, as I said, was mortality. Early post-MI mortality has nothing to do with SGLT2 inhibitors. Stent thrombosis, rupture, you know, cardiogenic shock, whatever happened. I mean, SGLT2 inhibitors are not going to do it. The average time to development of heart failure in our trial was somewhere in the neighborhood of 3-4 months. The average time post heart failure follow up was shy of a year. And in that group, there were only 53 deaths, right? So I think for me, the issue here is the trial design. We don't do 5-year follow up design. We don't do design.
Yeah.
With you know, we do design with composite endpoint, not with singular endpoints where we collect, you know, 700 mortality events and all that kind of stuff. So to me, if you're reducing 30% heart failure hospitalization risk, I think it's only a matter of time, but that's your clinical state, not the data.
Now, I'm practically speaking, we potentially, with that vision in mind of potentially selecting patients with MI who are at high risk for heart failure, treating them with an SGLT2 inhibitor. So let's talk about practical aspects. Many of these patients were just revascularized, received a large contrast load, are often co-treated at the same time with a renin-angiotensin system inhibitor, perhaps a mineralic corticoid receptor antagonist, in a finite amount of time prior to hospital discharge. And now we're adding a third therapy, potentially, that acts in preventing heart failure. And so SGLT2 inhibitor, can you talk a little bit about the kidney effects and tolerability early after MI?
Yeah, very, very important question. So on one hand, you can argue, we really don't care about safety. I mean, gosh, like, we have so much data on SGLT2 inhibitor safety. But remember, this is different. We have no data so far for acute MI, hemodynamic changes, ID contrast, procedures or surgeries, and simultaneous new initiation of RAS inhibitor, new initiation of MRA, and SGLT2 inhibitor, all like in 5 days, right? So safety was a concern. So every time we had a DSMB meeting, we were like, what? So no issues at all. There were no signals for safety concerns at all. Everything was consistent with what we already know about SGLT2 inhibitor, but interestingly enough, no signal for AKI or any renal safety concerns.
That's terrific. And it builds on, I mean, across all the trials, I mean, we've got COVID trials,
yes,
to show remarkably safe and well-tolerated,
yes,
and they survived this test of a post-acute MI population in terms of safety and tolerability. But I just want to say thank you so much for finally joining us on our podcast here. You know, you've been such a terrific mentor and advocate for Mutu and I for so many years. And congratulations on you really truly being the most popular guy at this conference. So thank you again for joining us on Don't Miss a Beat. And to our audience, thank you very much for listening. You can catch this episode of Don't Miss a Beat and all our prior episodes on hcplive.com or Spotify or Apple's podcast. Thank you very much for listening, and hope everyone enjoys the rest of the ACC.